Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has extraordinary intelligence and who has, thank God, been bringing it to bear on behalf of the free world is our first guest. He is Daniel Horowitz. These days, he is a columnist for a terrific outlet, The Conservative Review, Mark Levin's platform, among others. His column is entitled The Conservative Conscience, which he certainly is. He's also the author of a best-selling book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America, a subject we will turn to with him in a moment. Daniel Horowitz, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you back.
Great to be with you to talk some common sense.
A little bit of common sense. I think it's in short supply, as well as the rarefied intelligence that you power yours with. Let me talk to you first about this attack yesterday in New York City, the latest incident of jihadism, and a problem because it is possibly the case that there could be an awful lot more emigres from Bangladesh, or for that matter, elsewhere in the Muslim world, who seek to follow suit. Talk a little bit about the incident yesterday, what we know of it, and in particular, this possible demographic scourge.
Sure. I think it's pretty extraordinary. We've reached a point in our history where there's an attempted botched, I would say, suicide bombing on our shores, and maybe it gets half a day's news cycle. It's not even a big deal anymore, and it's completely out of the news this morning. That's pretty amazing. When I was growing up, this is something that was associated exclusively with the Middle East, and now we have brought that to our shores. And that is really the issue at hand. We have brought it to our shores. This is nothing that came over with an Air Force, a Navy. This is not even about ISIS or Al-Qaeda. This individual, from what has been reported, there was no interaction with the FBI. There were no known contacts with foreign terrorist entities. Certainly, he sympathized with them. The broader problem, and the problem that is much harder to defend against, is that this is a systemic problem in the culture cultivated from these clustered neighborhoods of fervent Sharia-adherent Muslims that we've let in large numbers. And this article you're referencing, I quantified after 9/11, and I list about 47 predominantly Muslim countries and the number of green cards we've issued to nationals of those countries. It's roughly 1.8 million through 2015, so that's probably about 2 million by now. And from a country like Bangladesh, a tremendous amount, 178,000, many of them are in this neighborhood where this jihadist was evidently living in Kensington, Brooklyn. It's called Little Bangladesh. And the problem here is it's much more systemic than, oh, well, maybe we made a mistake and let in one or two people with terrorist proclivities. It's not terrorism. Terrorism is the tactic born out of the broader culture. You wonder who's in that neighborhood, who's the family. And I think last night we found out when his family, through a spokesperson for this Islamic apologist group, put out a statement not, kind of disowning this kid, but saying that the law enforcement treated him in a manner that is unprecedented, and almost like they weren't even apologetic, which tells you we are letting in people to this country that, irrespective of whether they have known terrorism ties, they should never be here.
Yeah. But I did just want to say, Daniel, in your analysis of the 178,466 green cards issued to Bangladeshi nationals from 2001 to 2015, the only countries that we accepted more from were, wait for it, folks, Iran and Pakistan. What could possibly be going wrong? Daniel, let me turn to a related subject. Speaking of Sharia supremacism, we are, of course, seeing outbursts of violence in response to President Trump's announcement that he is going to recognize the reality of Israel's capital being Jerusalem and going to track with that reality by moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. You've mused about the dangers of trying to, well, you use the word placate. Another word that comes to mind is appease these Sharia supremacists by submitting, basically. Talk about that danger and how it operates at the moment as we're watching this play out in the Middle East and elsewhere in connection with this embassy decision.
It's amazing when you look at all of the arguments that are posited to oppose Trump's directive moving the embassy. It's all rooted in the fear of the Arab street. The Arabs are going to do this, they're going to do that, they're going to riot. And the amazing thing is that is precisely what has gotten us here. It's that 100-year mentality. It's been going on for 100 years. You know, this is the anniversary year of the centennial of the Balfour Declaration, which designated the entirety of the land west of the Jordan River to be a Jewish state.
And initially a good piece of real estate on the eastern side of the Jordan River, as I recall, right?
Exactly. In 1922, I guess it was limited by then to west of the Jordan River, but there was no such thing as creating an Arab entity west of the Jordan River, that's for sure. It never fully took root because the Arabs always rioted. And, you know, we always say violence doesn't pay, but when it came to the Arab street for the last 95 years or so, it did pay. And that's what was so important about Trump being willing to punch right through this and say, you know what, I'm not going to give in to their tantrums. Now, unfortunately, what we're seeing happening today is that I think you're actually seeing the European street riot more than the Arab street in most Arab countries, because most Arab governments, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they've kind of moved on from this whole PLO issue. They know it's a farce. Whereas a lot of the European governments, really, they have a stronger reaction against Israel than Saudi Arabia and Egypt and some other Arab countries, as well as the people on the streets. And this ties into our first discussion that we've allowed the Arab streets into Western civilization, and they're actually more vocal and virulent against Trump's decision than much of the Arab street in the Arab states.
You know, one of the pieces of this, Daniel, that I'd like to get your thoughts on, our friend Dr. Daniel Pipes has been talking for some time about the need to reposition the whole so-called peace process from the context of this trying to appease the Arab street and, you know, driven by fear of violence, to one that recognizes, again, the reality that Israel defeated the Palestinians, among other Arabs, notably in 1967 when it took control of all of this real estate, and that the way this should work now is on the basis of that, you know, sort of dictation of terms rather than this endless effort to induce the Palestinians to be reasonable. What are your thoughts about that and how that might fit into what Donald Trump has started with his embassy decision?
Sure, what Daniel Pipes is talking about and really what the president's decision hopefully is leading to is the original policy adopted by the U.S. government in 1922. It was a resolution that passed unanimously in Congress and signed by President Warren Harding. You look at the congressional debate back then, and it was fascinating, just fascinating material, that all the members of Congress recognized one principle here, that it was kind of a diverse area. It was no man's land. It was governed by the Ottoman Turks before World War I. You had a continuous Jewish presence. You had some random smattering of Arabs, but certainly no cohesive, quote unquote, Palestinian nation there. And they understood that it was only the Jews that would have the ability to govern it and recognize everyone's civil and religious liberty rights and protect all the holy sites, whereas the Arabs wouldn't. And they were proven right over time that with the Arabs, it's always living by the sword. It's always the threat of violence. And that's the thing. We're always working around their threats of violence. What needs to happen is what they said should happen. And I quote from his Congressman Walter Chandler from New York and on the House floor. He said, you know, the Jews need to control the entire area, and they can and will presumably respect everyone's civil rights. If the Arabs won't cooperate, they should be forced to sell their land. If they decline to do that, they should be removed. unfortunately, that's what it's come to, because it's either that or the annihilation of anyone who doesn't submit to Sharia.
Amen. Daniel Horowitz, extraordinarily important thoughts and insights into the challenges that we're facing both abroad and here. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work that you do at Conservative Review, Daniel, and elsewhere. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Daniel Greenfield joins us. We'll talk about, Little Bangladesh, among other instances of Sharia on the march, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is my delight to say we are joined by another Daniel, Daniel Greenfield. He is a blogger par excellence under the nom de guerre of Sultan Knish. You can also find his work at the Freedom Center, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is a Shulman Journalism Fellow. He contributes mightily through other outlets as well, including the New York Sun, Fox News, and the like. He is always welcome here. We're delighted to have him to talk about an interesting piece that he just recently penned about Little Bangladesh in Brooklyn, New York, among other topics. Thank you, Daniel, so much for joining us. It's good to catch up again.
It's an honor.
So tell us a little bit about this Little Bangladesh. We were talking earlier in the program with Daniel Horowitz about the massive numbers of Bangladeshi nationals who were given green cards since 9/11. It seems as though a fair number of them have wound up in one of the boroughs of New York City. Talk about that, if you would.
When we talk about no-go zones in Europe, they begin as close-knit ethnic communities, and initially it's considered a good thing. Then, of course, they develop their very insular culture into a hostile xenophobic response to the larger city in general. And you have these places in the United States. You have a number of little Mogadishus, and they've produced terrorists and terrorist accomplices for Somalis. And you have little Bangladesh in New York. It's a place in Brooklyn. And when you go there, it no longer feels like Brooklyn. It no longer feels like America. Instead, it feels like another country entirely. The current terrorist has links to little Bangladesh, but we've had a number of previous violent incidents that had links to little Bangladesh, including a terror plot and a decapitation plot.
This is such an important insight. Our friend Rahim Kassam has written a book on the subject of no-go zones, as I'm sure you know, and it is important to realize that they don't come fully sprung. They evolve over time. And at this point, it's I assume, fair to say that it's not a full-on area that the law enforcement and other authorities of the United States dare not enter, as is true of some places in Europe. But it's a building, I guess, is what you're saying, Daniel Greenfield.
It's an embryonic situation, and as it escalates, it gets worse and worse. Now, most people don't think of Bangladeshis as having a very significant presence. It sounds like another obscure nationality until, once again, it pops into the headlines, much like Uzbeks, but actually there are over 80,000 Bangladeshis in New York alone. And when you have these kinds of concentrations and these kinds of numbers, that automatically will create communities where just America does not apply, where America does not exist. And the next step for that is violence against America and exclusivity for the territory itself, for this kind of embryonic no-go zone.
Let me quickly turn to Europe with you. It's an important battleground in what I think of as the war for the free world, though at the moment it seems as though Western civilization is largely on the losing end of that battlefield. Talk a little bit about, if you would, several of the things that you've been writing on in your column, Sultan Knish, at Front Page Magazine. The anti-Semitism in Europe, for starters, evident most recently in an attack in Amsterdam on a kosher deli, and how the law enforcement authorities responded to it.
It's a very striking scene, because most people by now have probably heard that a Muslim migrant refugee smashed up a kosher restaurant, actually, over in Amsterdam. What's striking when you watch the video is that this guy is making absolutely no efforts to be subtle. He's got a kefiyeh on his head. He's waving a Palestinian flag. That's the PLO flag, actually. He's got a club in his hand. He's going down the street and shouting, Allahu Akbar. And the police are very aware of this. This is a touristy area. This is not a no-go zone by any stretch of the imagination. So the police are right there. The car pulls up just as he's approaching the kosher restaurant. Two police officers walk over to him. They're trying to maybe tell him to stop this right now, but they don't actually make any move to stop him as he starts smashing the windows of this kosher restaurant. And that's incomprehensible to us because, of course, if you go around Washington, D.C. or New York City or Los Angeles and you walk over to a restaurant and start smashing in the windows, the police will automatically stop you. That's not the case over there, and that says quite a bit about the relationship between the Muslim population and the law enforcement. And it says why Jews are so terrified, why so many of them are leaving Europe, because really up until the point where he goes into the restaurant itself and they assume that people might be endangered, they let him do it.
Unbelievable. Let me ask you, speaking of the UK and what's going on there at the hands of these Sharia supremacists, Daniel Greenfield, to talk about what is called sex grooming. Somehow that seems to be an awfully antiseptic term for what is actually involved, to say nothing of the magnitude of it in Britain. Talk a little bit about what it is and who's doing it and how it is that they've gotten away with so much of this for so long.
Well, sex grooming consists of men targeting underage girls. The grooming part refers to prepping them for abuse, basically, by emotionally manipulating them, giving them gifts, sucking them into this kind of group, and then abusing them. It's become commonplace with Muslim communities, and there's actually been a fairly mainstream report on this now, which says that 84% of those convicted of the crime in the UK are Pakistanis. That's a very startling number, but it's a number that we effectively know. There have been hundreds of cases. These cases were preceded by extensive police and cover-ups to conceal them. Officers who attempted to investigate these cases were dubbed racist. Basically, nobody wanted to hear about it at all. Now there's actually a report documenting some of the scale of it, but the actual scale is probably far beyond the hundreds of convictions and cases that have been obtained. Now, the troubling thing about this is that it is very obviously an expression of cultural differences. The Pakistanis and other Muslims who target these young girls are invariably, and again, this is in a report that just came out now by a mainstream source, are targeting native British, English, white girls. The perpetrators are Pakistanis, and there's the perception on their part, again, and this is in the report, this is not even something that I'm attributing to it, that they're fair game because they're immodest, because they're immoral, because they're not being protected by their fathers or parents, and thus they can be exploited and abused. And this is very much a difference between the cultural and religious norms of Pakistan and other Muslim countries and those of the West. This goes back to the very origins of Islam, because if you think about the origins of the hijab and the burqa, it was to distinguish Muslim women from non-Muslim women so they wouldn't be abused, so they wouldn't be, in the words of the Quran, molested. And this is the same ethos that's coming to the West.
Indeed it is. And that brings me to a related point, Daniel Greenfield, and I'd like to ask your thoughts on it. We are, of course, in the midst of a great national controversy, I guess it's fair to call it. Conversation seems to be too understated. Crisis, some would argue, over how badly men in this country are treating women. Not all of us, obviously, but a fair number, particularly prominent ones. And yet there is almost no conversation about what seems to be an institutionalized misogyny, the fancy word for, you know, abusing women, on the part of Sharia. And I just wonder what you make of that. How is it we could be giving these whether they're Pakistanis or whether they're others in this country and elsewhere, a pass when it comes to the everything from, wife abuse and beating to child marriage and female genital mutilation and honor killings?
It's a double standard, much like we're having now a conversation about how Bill Clinton or Al Franken could have been tolerated. Well, that was a double standard. But the bigger double standard, as you've mentioned, is Islam, because Islamists have been included in a coalition with feminists, with much of the usual social justice crowd, even despite the fact that Islam encourages domestic abuse. It encourages the idea that women our property. It says that women are not equal to men. It says this in black and white language. And that's the very opposite of feminism. Yet there is this insistence that Islam must be feminist because it's part of this larger coalition. So as is so often the case, the left has not examined its alliances. It's refusing to be consistent in this regard.
And enabling some of the worst behavior that one can imagine. Daniel, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your great work at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Sultan Kanish. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Elaine Donnelly joins us from the Center for Military Readiness. We'll talk about this latest judicial overreach involving transgender individuals in the military, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by the one and only Elaine Donnelly, an indispensable champion for our military and particularly for the men and women who serve in it, and the character of the armed forces that is so indispensable to its readiness and its effectiveness to do the mission that we assign it, which is protecting all the rest of us. Elaine, of course, is the founder and president of a terrific organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on both a Department of Defense and presidential commission looking into various aspects of how we man the military, and she is an incredible resource. We're asking her to talk to us a little bit about this issue that has now gone to, I believe, a catastrophic point with a ruling by a federal judge yesterday involving transgender personnel. And Elaine knows a lot about the subject. Elaine, welcome back. It is so good to have you. I'm so sorry it's on the occasion of this decision by the courts, but I'm interested in your thoughts on all of that.
Thank you, Frank, and for that very nice introduction. President Trump really stuck his neck out last August when he said we're going to have an end to political correctness in the military. He indeed was doing the military a favor. And the media, of course, had a field day. They didn't like his tweets. But in August, August 25th, President Trump did issue formal directives, and the Department of Defense has had the responsibility to follow through according to what this president wants. Now, we have a problem here. President Trump is being let down. And an activist judge, actually a couple of activist judges, are taking advantage of the opportunity to do something they do not have the power to do. We have a Washington, D.C. district judge who is trying to behave as supreme judicial commander of the military. Judge Kolar Kotelly is her name, and she's a district judge. She issued a preliminary injunction ordering the Department of Defense to ignore what the commander-in-chief says. The judge says that starting on January 1, the military has to do something it's never done in its history before, and that is to bring into the armed forces people who are known to suffer from a psychological condition, which makes them very likely to be undeployable in the military. There are lots of psychological conditions that make you non-deployable and therefore ineligible for military service. But this group, the transgenders, they have a political force behind them, and they are demanding special treatment to join the military, even though medical treatments, preparation for medical treatments, months of time off in order to recover, the Department of Defense is being ordered to take on all of this responsibility and cost just because this federal judge says that's the way it should be. So the Department of Justice should have filed an immediate request for a stay. This is a national security matter. The makeup of our armed forces is, I would say, even more important than the president's immigration travel ban order. And you would call it, he didn't stop fighting on that. There were district judges that opposed the president on that travel ban in at least three different states. Ultimately, the president fought that battle, and he did win, at least temporarily. The Supreme Court just a few weeks ago saw it his way. But on this issue, the Department of Justice didn't do anything for 3 weeks. So it's being reported in the Washington Post this morning that the judge, Kolar Kotelly, she in essence is mocking the Department of Justice and saying, well, if it really was that urgent, then you would have filed a request for a stay with, as she put it, more alacrity.
Elaine Donnelly, let me pick some of these pieces apart. there is a real concern about, for all the reasons that you've described, the impact of this decision on the readiness of the United States military, on its ability to, as I say, fight the nation's wars on behalf of all of us. The judge seems to have arrogated to herself this decision, and it certainly sounds as though the president has not been well served either by the Department of Defense or the Department of Justice at this point. But it does sound as though she's creating a new right for men and women to serve in the military. And the idea in the past that you had to meet certain fitness standards, whether they were physical to the psychological well-being of individual soldiers, I mean, and sailors and so on. This is breaking new ground in a very troubling way. To the extent that that's a correct assessment of what's going on, it seems as though it can only exacerbate what, in a conversation I had with Dakota Woods recently from the Heritage Foundation, is already a desperate state of unreadiness for our armed forces. Is that how you see it?
That's right. The implementation plans that my organization analyzed earlier this year show that the Department of Defense is prepared to allow people who are confused about their gender identity many months off, including almost a year off, to experience what they call real life experience, pretending to be a person of the opposite sex. Other people have to fill in, of course, when transgender people or people who think they might be transgender are taking time off to search their psyche to find out where the truth is. We also know that doctors and nurses are supposed to be ordered to carry out very controversial hormone treatments and or surgeries on people who are trying to change their gender. This is scientifically impossible. Gender is not, it is not assigned at birth. It is identified at birth. And yet the Department of Defense has embraced this delusion. And doctors and nurses who have a problem with this for ethical reasons or personal conviction, they have no choice. They're going to have to carry this out. Costs and consequences will be enormous. Even though we're talking about a small number of people, you're going to have a lot more people coming into the military after January 1, unless the Department of Justice gets its act in gear. They're going to be joining the military, and why not? The benefits are tremendous. This creates an incentive that is not in the interests of military readiness. We also have this issue of suicide risk, which is not diminished even after surgery. And we know that women are subjected to situations in which they're supposed to accept persons of the opposite sex in their private locker rooms, shower rooms, and the like. Given all the irony about sexual harassment that's going on right now, isn't that ironic?
Ironic is one word for it. Insane is another word for it. It is only going to compound a problem that you've called attention to over the years, Elaine Donnelly, of pregnancies in the military, with all that that entails for readiness impact as well. But when you add on top of it the immense costs that are associated with these sex change operations and so on, it's just clearly unsupportable for a military that's already strapped to do the missions that it is being assigned. Lastly, one question that keeps arising, and it kind of sheds light on the larger problem here, the sort of cottage industry that has been built up to promote these social engineering operations in the military, the Palm Center, for example, and the RAND Corporation. I can't get a clear fix on how many people there actually are serving in the United States military at the moment who are transgender. RAND is said to be claiming it's 10,000 people. I find that very hard to believe.
These numbers are puffery. They have no substance behind them. The Associated Press reported that only 250 people who are in the military and transgender under the orders of Obama have asked for transgender treatments, 250. That's a far cry from thousands and thousands. But the RAND, they make up numbers as they choose. They simultaneously, in a report last year, said that the cost would be minimal. Logic and reality does not matter. It's all about perception management to create a reality that doesn't exist. But here's the real problem. a person who helped to write that bogus RAND report is in a high-level position in the Department of Defense. His name is Anthony Curta, and guess what? He recently told the Senate Armed Services Committee that he has been in charge of this so-called panel of experts that's going to tell President Trump what his transgender policy should be. This is an Obama holdover. He hasn't been fired. He's been promoted to be the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. He is running this show. Now, again, the president is not being well served.
Or the country, or the military, or the national security, all of the above. Elaine Donnelly, we are hard out of time, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate your painstaking, careful analysis of these issues. You can find out more about it at cmrlink.org. Please check it out, folks. And give Elaine a hand for the work she's doing. It is truly the Lord's work, I believe, in this and in so many other areas. Keep it up, my dear. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman. We'll talk with him about Bitcoin right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, our duty expert on economic warfare. He is Kevin Freeman. He has a wonderful online resource that specializes in this field, globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also the author of two best-selling books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He's kind enough to join us each week, and I am pleased to say is one of the guys that we're turning to help us understand this phenomenon of Bitcoin. Kevin, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you, Frank. Doing great.
I'm interested, Kevin, in, as I think everybody is at the moment, this phenomenon of Bitcoin. We had today Wall Street beginning to sell futures for this cryptocurrency. The price has gone up by some 20%, I'm told, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. What's going on here? And is this the current 21st century equivalent to the tulip bubble, or is this the real deal?
Well, what's going on is that the prices for Bitcoin went from pennies to $17,000, and it is being acknowledged by the Chicago commodities exchanges. It's being traded futures, as you mentioned, and I think the jury is still out as to whether this is a tulip mania or a Ponzi scheme. A lot of people think that it is. But the reality of it is, and the message that I put on my blog, is the fact that there's so much interest in this tells us that people are worried about the global monetary system. They do not have confidence or faith in the traditional system that we've been operating under for the past several decades. The dollar as reserve currency is being challenged internationally. We've talked about that a lot. And the fact that people want Bitcoin is because they're scared that the current way that we do money may not last too long.
To the extent that that's the case, Kevin, what role are governments like Russia's and China, both of which have made no secret of their desire to displace the dollar as the reserve currency, in doing at the moment with respect to Bitcoin?
Well, I think that's where it really gets interesting. Russia has recently stated that they would like to replace the dollar as the petrodollar with a cryptocurrency of some type, that oil should be traded in something that could be kept in the blockchain. It's kept universally. This is the exact same concept as when we went away from U.S. controlling the domain naming of the internet through ICANN. Oh, it's got to be controlled by an international body. The argument is now being made that the dollar should not be under the control of the United States. We need to replace it with an international alternative, and a cryptocurrency that everybody can see that's in the blockchain and so forth would be a great replacement for that. So governments are getting involved in this. The Japanese have embraced Bitcoin. The Russians rejected it. Then they embraced it. The Chinese are trying to control it. But everybody's seeing this as an alternative monetary system that, frankly, will reduce American sovereignty and American global power.
And at the end of the day, we're having the Fed meeting today as we speak. By this evening, when this program airs, people will know what it's decided. It's widely expected, I gather, that it is going to increase interest rates. This is part of, I assume, Kevin Freeman, a central bank's desperate bid to remain relevant after having, you know, essentially printed very, very substantial amounts of greenbacks and now is trying to somewhat, you know, straighten things out. But it's happening at a time when, as you say, the dollar is under considerable strain. What is the Fed's role in all of this, and does it in fact matter at the moment?
Well, the Fed has been somewhat schizophrenic on the idea of cryptocurrencies. At one point, they've, you know, come out and said that they're a danger. A Fed vice chairman called them a real danger to the global system. But other times, the Fed has said, well, we might produce our own cryptocurrency. You know, I suppose it's okay as long as they control it. But that's where we get into this tug of war that's taking place between those who say, and Bitcoin is at the center of it, those who say that Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme and it's a fraud, and there's legitimate arguments made that direction, but then others say it is the new form of money, it's a new replacement, and it is the system that we will be operating under. And we're watching that play out, and governments are getting involved, and the U.S. position, the SEC just today ruled that some cryptocurrency transactions were illegal. They're cracking down on those who are transferring large amounts of money. So we're watching this happen in real time. It will determine the future monetary system.
And to some extent, this is really unexplored territory. So hold on to your hats, folks. This can get pretty wild and woolly, especially if at the end of it all, the U.S. dollar ceases to be the reserve currency. And as we've talked about many times, Kevin Freeman, we wind up confronting the implications of that for sustaining the enormous debt that we've run up and having to do so on terms that are almost certainly unsustainable, it would seem. So a very challenging point to be leaving this topic on for the moment, but we will come back to it for sure. Kevin, let me ask you about a posting that you had at your site, globaleconomicwarfare.com. Back on the 3rd of December, it's a subject that's near and dear to my heart, the war on free speech. Talk about who's waging that war at the moment and your thoughts about how we might fight back against it, given that this really is arguably the foundational freedom in our country. And without it, we're going to find it very difficult to maintain the rest of them.
Well, absolutely. And there are a whole host of people that want to control us, whether they're Russia and China or the radical Islamists, Sharia adherent followers, or, you know, they're a group of people that don't want freedom and free speech. And that would take us, unfortunately, back to the Dark Ages in so many ways. But the war is taking place even in political parties and in the media. There's acceptable things that you can say, and now it's happening on college campuses. And my blog post was talking about how that is a form of economic warfare. If you can control speech, that you can control economics. And I pointed out an award that you received, Frank, and then a panel discussion that that was recently held that you had at the Center for Security Policy on how free speech is under fire, both by Marxists and Islamists. And the red-green axis, as you call it.
Develop that thought just a moment, Kevin, because I think that the connection between speech and economics isn't as obvious as it probably needs to be. Develop it.
Well, if you don't have the ability to speak, then you can control what people consume, what they think, how they act. It really has gone hand in hand, freedom and free markets. In the United States, the whole Adam Smith proposition and so forth, if we didn't have the Bill of Rights, it's unlikely that our economy would have built as it did, because you have government controlling things, and when they control things, they ultimately control markets where you spend money. And we also have the Supreme Court has ruled that money is a form of speech. And so if you give money to a certain candidate, that's a form of speaking. So they're almost indistinguishable. Money is an expression like speech, both from court rulings, but also reality. So if we don't exercise the free speech speaking, we won't be able to exercise the free speech monetarily.
Fascinating point, and one I think that it's pretty clear the Chinese, among other adversaries, as you mentioned, certainly the Sharia supremacists have internalized as they seek to control our thought and our even our situational awareness about what they're up to with the Confucius Institutes in the case of the Chinese, among other instruments, and of course the Muslim Brotherhood hard on the case, along with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Kevin was kind enough to plug a couple of things we've been involved in at the center. Check it all out at securefreedom.org. Kevin Freeman, you can find at globaleconomicwarfare.com. And of course, with us each week. Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. And I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.